You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Before I start today's show, I just want to mention that if you like Write the Book, it does us a great favor for you to go into iTunes and rate us, write a review, like us on Facebook, or tweet about the show. That's a wonderful way to get the word out about Write the Book, and we thank you so much for thinking about doing that. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with the author Tiffany McDaniel, whose debut novel, The Summer That Melted Everything, came out this month from St. Martin's Press. Tiffany McDaniel is an Ohio native whose writing is inspired by the rolling hills and Buckeye woods of the land she knows. She is the winner of The Guardian's 2016 Not the Booker Prize for The Summer That Melted Everything. The novel was also a Goodreads Choice Award double nominee in both fiction and debut categories, a current nominee for the Lillian Smith Book Award, and has been recently announced as a finalist for the Ohioana Literary Award and the Women's Fiction Writers Association Star Award for Outstanding Debut. Here's a little information about The Summer That Melted Everything. Fielding Bliss has never forgotten the summer of 1984, the year a heat wave scorched Breathed, Ohio, the year he became friends with the devil. Sal seems to appear out of nowhere, a bruised and tattered 13-year-old boy claiming to be the devil himself, answering an invitation. Fielding Bliss, the son of a local prosecutor, brings him home where he's welcomed into the Bliss family, assuming he's a runaway from a nearby farm town. When word spreads that the devil has come to Breathed, not everyone is happy to welcome this self-proclaimed fallen angel. Murmurs follow him and tensions rise, along with the temperature as an unbearable heat wave rolls into town right along with him. As strange accidents start to occur, riled by the feverish heat, some in the town start to believe that Sal is exactly who he claims to be. While the Bliss family wrestle with their own personal demons, a fanatic drives the town to the brink of a catastrophe that will change this sleepy Ohio backwater forever. I began my interview with Tiffany McDaniel by asking how she began to work on a book in which the devil is invited to come to town. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Yeah, so this novel really started, it was the summer I was 28, and it was one of those really hot Ohio summers. I felt like I was melting. And I do start writing a novel with two things, the title and the first line. And so once I had that title, I wrote the first line, and I don't outline or plan the stories ahead of time. So I didn't yet know everything that would be involved in this book. And once I had that first line, I realized, okay, this is going to be about a really hot summer. It's going to be about the devil. And it really does evolve with each new word and page that I write. And I don't do character sketches or anything like that. So the moment you see them first appear on the page is kind of when they first appear in my mind. And then I just continue their development across the pages. And I never really know exactly how the story is going to end until I write that very last sentence from the very last page. But I like that. I like being just as surprised as the reader is reading it the first time as I am writing it the first time. So I like that sort of not knowing where it's going to go. But it started with that title, and it just kind of unfolded from there.
So here's a question for you, because actually, the way you're describing working is sort of the way that I work when I write, which is to sort of not have an outline, not have a very clear idea about where I'm going. Does it take you a really long time to write a book?
But my thing is, once I start, writing sort of the bare bones of the book, I get really anxious and I want to finish it as quick as I can, because if I let it sit for too long, it can begin to lose its essence for me. Okay. And so I try to write from beginning to end. I don't jump around when I first write it. I write it straight through from beginning to end. And that usually takes me about a month to get those.
Gosh.
And that sounds like a short time, but that's just kind of laying the bones down. And once I have those bones, and it's almost like building a body. When you're writing a book, you put the bones down, you add your layers of muscle and tissue, and then your skin, and you sort of do the cosmetic details in the top, you know, the birthmarks and the moles, and that polishing stage, that sort of laying on of the other layers, those stages can take months longer. So for me, the sort of initial stage is always a month, because I just want it out of me and I want it on that page. And then after that, you know, sort of elaborating on that story and sort of taking it further, that can take longer. And the quality stage for me really comes in that copy editing stage at the very end, which can take even months longer, where you're constantly reading and rereading and trying to catch every little thing. So it is sort of like building that body, at least for me.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Do you do NaNoWriMo?
No, I don't. What is that?
That's National Novel Writing Month. So it's the month of November. A lot of people will sit down and write a novel in a month. And then they have a very active online community where they sort of share their number of words at the end of each day. And I just wondered if that was the month that you choose to do your bare bones.
Oh, no, because I'm not plugged into kind of social media. I've never had social media. So if there's any sort of online thing, I'm usually not too aware of it or too kind of plugged into it. I tend to kind of, you know, take a step back a little bit from technology. So all that stuff, I'm sort of not touching the know on.
Good for you. That probably makes you much more productive.
It does. It really does.
Okay, let's talk about the two characters who I would sort of call your two main characters, the first one being the narrator, whose name is Fielding Bliss, and then the next main character, who maybe is the main character, is Sal. I wonder how you came upon these boys, and if you can talk a little bit about developing each of their characters.
Yes, so when I was thinking of the narrator for the novel, I wanted it to be the story seen through the eyes of a 13-year-old boy. It's an age that we're really beginning to shed our innocence and really take on that maturity that we'll end up having for the rest of our lives. And
right.
I wanted him to be a character who was on the cusp of becoming a man. And also they say that Joan of Arc was 13 when she first heard the voices, and that was sort of aligning with that divine theme within the novel. And I thought it was a good time in Fielding's life to really begin to hear those voices that would also begin to shape him and who he would become. And he, of course, ages in the book to 84 years of age, and I wanted that to sort of continue after that summer to explore the effects that those events when he was 13 had on the rest of his life. And Sal, I wanted him to also be 13 along with Fielding. So they're also at that age together, and they're on this sort of coming of age journey. And I wanted them also to be children, because there's the character in the novel, Elohim, who is a man of shorter stature. And I wanted them all to sort of be in that same height range, where it didn't feel like it was a battle between children and adults. It really felt like it was a battle between just people trying to figure out who they are in this world. So that's really how their characters came to be and why they came to be.
Okay, great. So now Fielding, as I said, narrates the book, and he does so from the first person. And we get to see two different times in his life. One is 1984, when he's 13 years old, and that's when the events of the novel unfold. And then actually there's an elderly point of view of Fielding many years later. I guess it would be 71 years later. He's recollecting these events. So I'm curious, first of all, why the first person? Is that just how it came to you, or is that your favorite narration to be in? And also, why two different time periods for Fielding?
First person is my favorite way to write all my stories that I have. I have 8 completed novels so far. This is my first published, but it's actually my 5th or my 6th written, so it's not my first written novel. But all of them so far do have that first person narration. It feels like I'm really there inside the character. So for me, it's the best way to write. And, you know, others would disagree. And of course, you kind of want to go with the way that fits you and kind of fits the story you're telling.
Right.
And as far as why I chose the two different time periods in Fielding's life, he ages to 84, so it's kind of running parallel to the year 1984. And the 84 number in the book is important because it's sort of drawing themes with George Orwell's novel 1984, mm-hmm. Which is also exploring that herd mentality and the preservation of individual thought, which are things that work within my novel too. So I wanted to draw those parallels with Fielding's age, but I also wanted to have him become an old man and experience things in his life after that summer and see how those other moments in his life would end up being affected by the things he experienced, the sort of tragedies and all that during that summer he was 13, and how it would affect him throughout the rest of his life. With a lot of my novels, I do tend to have those older narrators looking back at a particular moment in their life and sort of exploring how that affected them. So that's sort of something that I personally like to do as an author, is sort of take that under examination and stuff. So I suppose it's probably just a writing thing for me, but I think it's also something that works best for my characters.
That's awesome. You know, it's interesting. I was going to ask you why 1984, and I assumed it had to do with your choice of subject matter, including the AIDS epidemic. But if it was really inspired by Orwell, then did you come upon the AIDS epidemic in doing your research and realize that would be a very important subject in this time period? And is that how it became part of the novel?
Well, when I was thinking about the 80s, and, you know, unfortunately, when you write about the 80s, you're almost obligated to sort of mention the AIDS epidemic, but I didn't want to just mention it. I wanted to really write about how that disease was casting its shadow on the nation at that time, because it was an emerging thing and people didn't know too much about it. They didn't know, you know, how you could get it. There was a lot of fear associated with it. And so I wanted to take that and sort of explore it within that Midwestern region, because I hadn't read any stories that kind of tackled how that disease was sort of affecting those who were homosexual within that Midwestern part of our country. So for me, that's how that sort of came about, was wanting to examine that important part of the 80s and how it was going to be affecting my characters.
Okay. All right. Great. One thing that was really interesting to me as I was doing the research to talk to you today, I did some reading online about what people are saying about the book. And one thing that, well, first of all, I'm from Ohio. I'm from Newark, Ohio, which is just east of Columbus. But anyway, so as I'm reading people's reactions to your book, I keep seeing people talk about how this is a Southern Gothic tale. This is Southern literature, Southern fiction. I kept wanting to say, no, it's Ohio. Have you noticed that people are saying that? And do you have any idea why they're saying that?
I have noticed that. And, you know, I say it's Midwest Gothic. If they want to put Gothic in there, that's fine. But I would definitely say it's Midwest literature. I'm not entirely sure why they're placing it in sort of the Southern portion. It could be the dialect in the book, which a lot of people don't know that about Southern Ohio, that they do have a very strong accent, and an accent that is really all their own. I don't have it because I came from more central part of the state, but Southern Ohio, Scioto County, that's where I would spend my childhood summers and school year weekends. On the acreage my father was left by his parents, because that's where my parents grew up and it's where my extended family is. So it was a culture that I was exposed to a lot and that I really loved. And it is certainly a landscape that has shaped me as an author. And so I would really say it's Midwest literature, and I think people will say it's Southern, because when you think of that that genre, Southern Gothic, you have such heavyweights in it. You have William Faulkner and Carson McCullers and Flannery O'Connor, and so you have that really rich literature there, and I think it could be casting a shadow over the other genres, the other places, you know, like the Midwestern
Although it's not a bad thing to be mistaken for, really.
Oh, it's not. Absolutely not.
Okay, I wanted to, as we said earlier, part of the book has to do with the devil coming to town, or a young man identifying himself as the devil. And one thing that I really enjoyed was reading Sal's explanation of what hell is like. He says that hell is a hallway of doors, and behind each door is a suffering of the individual soul. And then he goes on to describe a number of doors that if you open them, what you would see inside. And the vision that you see wouldn't necessarily be one person's hell, but apparently it is this person's hell. Do you remember writing that? And do you remember how that came to you? That was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm always kind of surprised how these stories come out, because I do get in that moment, I'm happen to be working at that certain page. So, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, sometimes it comes easily, something is there. Sometimes you have to sit there and wait a little longer for it to come out. And, you know, I was writing that part, and I don't know, I instantly thought of the hallway of doors, and I thought, okay, this is kind of how Sal would see it, and this is how he would describe what hell is like. I didn't necessarily want it the stereotypical hell of a lot of flames and demons running around prodding people. I wanted it to be unique to Sal, and I wanted him to have this way of explaining hell that touched on that sort of human experience. And I wanted it to be a hell that would almost be individualized, but sort of kept in this place where everyone went, but yet you experienced hell on a very personal and individual level.
Right. It still sounded pretty awful, given the whole eternity part of it. But
right, exactly.
All right. I'm sure that every single interviewer asks you this question, but we have got to talk about your character names. You have names like, as we've said, Fielding, and then his father is Autopsy Bliss. There's a character named Elohim, which is, of course, the name of God in Judaism. There's Flint, there's Grand, and then the town itself is spelled like breathed, but I think it's breathed.
Breathed. Yep.
Okay, so let's just talk about, like, where are you getting this stuff?
Yeah, well, the names, they do have a purpose. Let's start with Bliss. Bliss, I wanted the family to really have this happy name, this joyous name, because, you know, they were a very happy family before all these events came to take place. And so they're really beginning to fall from the paradise and the bliss of their own name that they'd always sort of lived in and lived with. And the reason for Fielding's name was because I wanted a character, when you think of a field, you think of a place that grows and you have life there. And when he's young, he certainly has that opportunity to really grow into a really beautiful field, into a really great man. But unfortunately, what happens to him sort of takes his field and it turns it barren. So we see him as being someone who is living both sides of a field, in the good season and in the bad season. And that's sort of more of a reach with his name, but that was sort of what I was going for. And with Sal, his name came about because of the combination of Satan with Lucifer, and that's explained in the book. And Autopsy, his name, I had seen the word Autopsy that day I was writing his character. And I was, of course, familiar with the word, the dead body on the cold slab about to be cut open and examined. And I thought, yes, this is the perfect name for someone who one day invites the devil. And every time a reader hears that word throughout the book, my hope is that they really begin to look at the story as being old Fielding at the end of his life. He's climbing up on the cold slab, and he's sort of cutting himself open, performing almost a self-autopsy to sort of find out what went wrong in his life and what's killed him. So, you know, it's almost like the story is one big autopsy being performed. So that was the reasoning for the patriarch's name. And the reasoning for Grand's name was his full name is actually Grandfather. And it said the reason the book is because of the cloth, but also a grandfather is someone who ages, who gets old, who gets wrinkles. Mm-hmm. And Grand, I don't want to give anything away, but that speaks to what happens to his character. And he's someone who is very wrapped up in youth. And also, his name serves a dual purpose because Grand really means someone who is fantastic, spectacular. And to Fielding, who is seeing his brother through these rosy colored lens, really looks at his older brother as someone who can do no wrong, who is perfect and grand. And the name for Stella, she's the wife and the mother who stays indoors. She's afraid to come out. And when I thought of Stella, I thought of this stifling heat and this sort of indoor stifling heat. And she's a very indoor woman. And so I sort of took that stifling because that would be a very weird name to have. So I took that and Stella sort of came out of that. So,
okay.
And with Dresden, there's a little town here in Ohio called Dresden. That I have fond memories of, but also the Dresden porcelain, which is very fragile, and she's a character who is very fragile as well. So that sort of really represents her.
Okay.
And Granny the dog. She's I wanted her to have a very human name and a name that really made her feel as if she were part of the family, as if she was the grandmother of the family.
Yeah.
So to really sort of include her in the family. And Breathed, finally, that was the name of the town. And it's a town that I've used in all my novels so far. And that came from because I was told my maternal grandfather was born in Breathitt County, Kentucky, which is spelled T-H-I-T-T at the end. So I just changed the spelling and you know, sort of a nod to him. I made the town's name Breathed. But it works, too, because it feels like a place of breathing and things like that. So it sort of all found a place. But, yeah, with names, I do try to add a subtle meaning to the stories. They do have a purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one that you didn't mention, but actually that's fine because I want to take it to the next step, and that is Elohim. It's interesting to me that the boy who identifies himself as the devil is a very, in some ways, a very positive character who we come to love. And then Elohim, although maybe we can have a fondness for him, it turns out that perhaps he's not so godlike, and I won't give anything away there either. But the play of our expectations. You play a lot with our expectations in this book. I don't know if I have a question there. I'm just saying.
So Elohim, it's the name for God in the Hebrew Bible. And I wanted someone who was named God on one side of the battle and someone who was named the devil on the other side. And it's about taking those two things and sort of turning them on their head and realizing that the one who is called God isn't necessarily godly, and the one who is called the devil isn't necessarily devilish. So it's about determining who these people are without that name attached and really finding out, you know, if they're good, if they're evil on a very human level without having that sort of name clouding over their person.
Yeah. One thing that I thought you did very well, and I think this is something that's changing in our culture generally, and that is the treatment of appearance of people, and specifically in this case, Sal's race. When we first come upon Sal on page 11, the description is he was so very dark and small in those overalls, like I was looking at him through the opposite end of a telescope. So there is this description of him, and yet we don't know that he's African-American for 30 more pages. And I found that really interesting. And I wondered if you were trying to be subtle about race when you first introduced Sal.
I was, absolutely. I didn't want to just bring him on and say, oh, he's black, as if that was sort of the one thing that identified him and set him apart. I really just wanted to say, here he is, this is how he appeared, and get to know him before we really begin to label him this way or that way.
Right.
And a lot of people will ask me, why did I make Sal black? But I didn't make him black. He really appeared in my mind as he was, which the characters do. They sort of come with all their baggage, their clothing, their sort of stance, and their gender and their age and their skin color. They sort of come into the mind as they are. And it's our duty as the author to really bring these characters and all their truth to the page. And so I didn't realize how big a part race would end up playing within the novel until I continued to write it and his yeah. character developed. And this sort of response to his character was developing around him. And then I realized, okay, this is going to be sort of the thing that he, his own journey is focused on, and sort of how his presence, the response of his presence is sort of relayed within these pages. So it was a very natural evolution, I would say, his race. And certainly when he first appeared in the book, it was something that I didn't, you know, want to just call out, because when we have white characters, we don't always say, right. oh, John is here, he's white and he has brown hair. And, you know, it sort of, I wanted to give him style the same opportunity we give every other character, which is just to say his name and that he's here and this is who he is.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I thought I liked that so much. I felt like, first of all, I felt like he was a very fully developed character, and I really had a sense of who he was. And of course, an African American character is going to have race be part of his story, if it's at all a realistic depiction of this character's life. I'm just going to jump in here and interrupt us to tell you that you're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And this is an interview with Tiffany McDaniel, author of The Summer That Melted Everything. We are streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Okay. I loved that you had the epigraphs by Milton at the beginning of each chapter. Was that an 11th hour discovery that, oh, I want to do this, or was that always there?
So when I do write a novel, I like to title the chapters. And when I was thinking of the chapter titles for this novel, I immediately thought of Milton's Paradise Lost. I came across it when I was in my early 20s. And for me, this sort of story paralleling with my own really made sense, and it felt like the right opening to the chapter. Now, when I do title a chapter, I wait until I write the book, and then I title the chapters afterward, because I don't want the chapter titles to have a sort of dominance over the rest of the chapter. I want the chapter to really stand on its own, and the titles to sort of complement it, not necessarily direct the story in any way. So that's how the chapter titles here came about. I just felt like Paradise Lost was really paralleling these characters, because a lot of them are losing their own paradises in a way. So it made sense like that.
Yes, I get it. That's great. I was curious if maybe you were letting some of those epigraphs lead your plot, since you don't outline ahead of time. But that's interesting. You prefer to let the plot develop and then find appropriate chapter headings.
Yeah, and it's always surprising how those chapter titles will end up fitting into place, almost like a puzzle piece. You sort of scan the text, and if I see a certain word that I've used in my chapter, or if I see something like that, then that's how I'll use to connect to the chapter titles. And that's it's all about sort of building that connection without letting the chapter titles really overpower it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your writing style. You use a lot of analogy, and you use a lot of metaphor. One example is Stella, Fielding's mom's drawl, is described as being like raw vegetables, hard, rooted, and not yet ripe. And that's there's a lot of this being like that in your writing. And I'm wondering if that's your writing style generally, or did you feel the story should be told in this more analogy-driven way, in keeping with some of the other aspects of the story, like including parables, and there's like ancient story woven within. And so can you just talk about that?
Yeah, it does tend to be my style of writing. I've written poetry since I was a kid, and with poetry, you're allowed that sort of visual way with expressing the story through writing. And I think that, you know, it's just kind of, I don't know, it's kind of just how I've always written. I think every author is really born with a certain set of tools or a certain way that they're meant to write, and the thing is, it's unique to all of us. And it's, you know, because I'll get questions, why do you write so dark, or why do you write this way, as if it's a choice? But it's not a choice. It's really how I was born to write, as it is with every author. And I think what that does is it just gives the reader more choice and to choose, because a lot will say, well, why do you write your stories so tragic? Why do they have to be so sad and things like that? But I think some of us authors are born to write happier stories, and other authors are born to write more tragic tales. And that just gives the reader the opportunity to explore both those styles of writing and really have that, all of that in their reading diet, because you really do need to have happy stories. You also have to have sad stories, as to have that balance to sort of, because if you have too many books that are just focused so much on happy endings and all that, then you're really missing out, because it's the darker stories and the stories that really explore those human emotions of sadness and anger and rage. Those things really make those happier moments in our life more fulfilling, and we don't take those moments for granted. So for me, my writing style has always sort of been that way, and especially with this book, which is about my fifth or my sixth novel, you're really sort of seeing who I am as an author in a sort of midway through my writing collection so far. So, you know, I was kind of sad that first novel I wrote wasn't going to be my first published novel, but with this novel, I think it was really meant to be the first published novel, because you're getting a taste of my style and sort of my writing to come, I guess.
I felt like the style of the writing fit the story very well. That's sort of why I asked the question as I did. So that's interesting to me. So it's really your authorial voice and not necessarily just the voice of the narrative. So they went together well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I do tend to sort of have that, you know, kind of poetic turn of phrase. I think it's sort of about balancing the poet in me with the novelist in me, and knowing when to not overly use any sort of poetic devices in my novel and vice versa. So it's sort of just balancing that person in me and allowing the character to really come through, but be written in a way that, you know, is kind of unique to me, I guess.
Okay. All right. Now you talked about the darkness in your writing, or maybe in the choice of subjects. And in this book, there's absolutely some sadness. And I think that one of the things that drives the darkness in this book is fear. And you have a line in the book: "Fear is ignorance's first shadow." I really liked that line. I just wonder if you can talk about that as a theme in the book.
Yeah, a lot of these characters, they are experiencing fear, and they're also experiencing, you'll notice there's a lot of imagery throughout the book about teeth and things being consumed and things consuming. And that's, I think, wrapped up within the fear theme. We have these characters who are, you know, they're kind of, you know, Fidelia, for example, she's consumed by her anger. Stella is sort of consumed by her fear of the rain. Autopsy is consumed by his faith. Grand is sort of consumed by his fear of his identity and who he is. So these sorts of, you know, fear is an emotion that has teeth, and it can consume us if we let us. And we do see these sorts of cannibalistic traits with a lot of the characters. And certainly, I won't give too much away, but certainly with Elohim, we see, you know, these things that eat at us and eat at our emotions and eat at who we are as a person. So that theme of fear is really wrapped up with that theme of being consumed, because these characters, you know, even though they're adults, they seem to be on this journey with Fielding, sort of coming of age and really figuring out who they are. So, you know, that was certainly something that I wanted to tie the characters in with, was that same exploration of who they are and overcoming their fear and overcoming their sort of self-cannibalistic ways.
Yeah, that's interesting, putting it that way, self-cannibalistic. All right, I have another question about writing style, but this is just from a certain spot in the book. The opening of chapter 23 starts, "When I was 33, I met a man. My house was burning down, and he was the one with the hose come to save me." I liked that about him, that he put fires out, didn't start them. And then the next chapter, the next paragraph is very much like a song. And I wondered if that's what you had in mind when you wrote it. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. "Come here, memory of him. I'll make guitar songs out of his eyes. Come here, memory of him. Give me the Sunday." I'm not going to read that whole thing. "Come here, memory of him. Remind me of the morning sun. Come here, you memory of him, and give him well." To me, that sounded so much like a song. So, and I didn't read the whole thing because I don't want to give anything away, but I wonder if you can just tell me if that's what you had in mind.
Yeah, it was. You know, I was looking at these two characters, and it's also, I think, me sort of putting a little bit of poetry in the book. And, you know, this was a moment between those two characters, their relationship, and it really did feel like a song between them and something, you know, this relationship of so much music. And I wanted them to have a sort of very poetic explanation of them being together and what it was like with them being together, almost in a way to even make it mythic and all that, because, you know, it's one of those relationships that it's hard to explain without giving too much of the story away,
right.
But it was a relationship that I think was one of those shining moments in Fielding's life, and to phrase it up in any other way, I think, would have just been too mundane for Fielding to do, and I think really this was the best way to explain that sort of musical chemistry between the two of those.
Yeah, okay, great. Tiffany, I'm wondering if you've read any books lately that you would recommend to listeners.
I have, absolutely. I just read A Rather Haunted Life by Ruth Franklin. It's the bio of author Shirley Jackson, who is one of my favorite authors, and her novel, We Have Always Lived in the Castle, one of my favorite novels. So I would recommend Franklin's biography of her. And, you know, if you're interested in Jackson's work after that, definitely We Have Always Lived in the Castle. It makes a great pairing.
Yeah, I just reread The Lottery a few weeks ago. And I was trying to remember because that story is just so, so amazing. And I read it again. I'm just like, my God, she was unbelievable.
Yeah, it's one of those stories that sticks with you. And the first time you read it, and if you don't know the story, if you haven't heard it anywhere else, that first time you read it, it really catches you by surprise.
It does.
It is really well done on her part.
Absolutely. And I think back to the time period when she was writing, and I think, my goodness, you know, imagine how her readers must have reacted to her.
Yeah, because that was, I think, in either the 50s or the 60s or something like that. So it was definitely breaking new ground, and it really showcased her talent and her creative spirit. So, yeah, she's definitely one of my favorites.
She's amazing. How about, what are you writing these days? Do you have a new novel that you're working on?
I do. I just turned in the updated draft of that very first novel I wrote when I was 18. Because
wow.
I wrote that novel, and it took me 11 years to get a publishing contract for The Summer That Melted Everything. So it's been a long journey, and you know, during that 11-year journey, I wrote about 8 novels, and I felt like it was a good time to return to the beginning and to return to those characters I first wrote. So I have done that, and that novel is currently titled The Chaos We've Come From, and it's inspired by my mother's coming of age in Southern Ohio. You'll see the appearance of Breathitt, Ohio again, and you'll see some of the characters that make an appearance within the story from The Summer That Melted Everything. So it's not on contract yet. It hasn't been submitted or anything like that. But fingers crossed, you know, a publisher likes it, and
right. Hopefully
it can get in the pipeline.
That's great. And you said you're working on poetry, too. Is that right?
I do, yeah. I'm currently compiling my first poetry collection. It'll mostly be new poetry that hasn't been published yet in literary magazines or journals. So I'm excited about that. It's always, it sort of feeds the spirit to write poetry. So I'm excited to sort of wrap this one up.
Yeah. Okay, great. So I just have one last question for you, Tiffany. I did find out through reading about you online that you had written many novels and that this was your first. This is your publishing debut. But I wonder, just because I'm sure so many of my listeners are trying to get published and perhaps have had that long journey already, can you talk about finding an agent and your publishing journey with this book?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I wrote that first novel, like I said, at 18, and I was so ignorant of the publishing process at that age, just starting out. And this was a long time ago when we still mailed in queries to agents through the postal mail. It was before email. And so that's what I did. I would, you know, mail in my query letter and my manuscript to agents. And, you know, I was getting rejections upon rejections. And it would be about 5 to 7 years before I got my first agent. And, you know, I think you want to give up, but if you do give up, then you'll regret it for the rest of your life. So I soldiered on and I got an agent, and that first novel was clocking in at about 1,000 pages. So it was a hefty novel. And, and you know, the agent warned me, you know, it's really long. It's going to be hard to get anyone to take a chance on it. And it did go out on submission, and it was rejected by everyone it was sent to. So I learned that my first written novel wasn't necessarily going to be my first published novel. And I had heard that from authors before, but I didn't want to believe it. So one of the pieces of advice I would give to anyone who's out there on the publishing journey is to make sure that you have more than one written work so that you have something to fall back on. Because for many years, all I had was that first novel. And it went on submission. I was about 27 or so. And when it was rejected, I didn't have any other work to fall back on. So in 2 years, I wrote those 8 novels, which...
Wow.
Yeah, it should have been the novels I was writing during all those years I was working toward publication with the first novel. So I had to fit it in those 2 years. And, you know, so that I would definitely have other works to fall back on. That was, I think, one of my biggest mistakes, too, is that I dedicated so much time to that first novel. And then, you know, I was fortunate with The Summer That Melted Everything. It went on submission. It got rejected by everyone but one publisher. So I was very fortunate with that. And I would say you can't ever give up, and you can't ever accept one rejection as the rejection of everybody. Because, you know, when you start to feel that way, it's easy to get frustrated, and it's easy to, you know, to lose heart in what you're doing. But you really can't give up. I mean, I spent 11 years working toward publication, and if I would have stopped at any of those points, I wouldn't be where I am now. And it's certainly a journey that you have to have lots of patience for. And it's a journey that you really have to learn to pick yourself up on. But at the end of it, if you can come to the realization that the struggle makes you a better author and it gives you a maturity as an author, then that's sort of the light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, just never give up. That's the biggest piece of advice.
Okay. And are you still with the first agent who accepted that 1,000-page book?
I am not, no. Sometimes with agents... sometimes you get one and you're really excited and you think, okay, this is going to be the agent that I have throughout the rest of my career. Unfortunately, it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes they don't like your next work. Like the agent I had first for The Summer That Melted Everything didn't like it, didn't want to put it out on submission. So when that happens, you have to part ways and you have to roll up your sleeves and get back out on the query journey. So I'm on about my third or so agent. So just because an agent gives you an offer representation, don't be afraid to, you know, part ways if that relationship isn't nurturing your career in a way that you need it to move forward.
Right.
And, you know, it's easier once you have an agent and then you go back out to query because you've had that experience representation and you can take that experience with you to find hopefully the agent that you'll have for many books to come. So it's a learning process.
Now, when you queried the second and third times, did you mention having parted ways with an earlier agent or not at first?
I did. And I also queried really wide. I did not only the U.S., but I did Canada and I did the U.K. as well. And the interesting thing is I got the most interest from the U.K. and Canada and then my home country, U.S., last. So I would say keep your submission wide. I did end up getting an agent in the UK, which if that's your only offer of representation and that's your only chance to sort of move forward, I would say take it. But it's not necessarily the best thing to be a U.S. citizen with a U.K. agent because tax purposes, and it can get really complicated. So that was one of the reasons I ended up parting ways with that agent in the U.K. was because it was just complicating things as being a U.S. citizen. But I queried wide because I was running out of agents here to query. And you know, once you've been working toward getting an agent for so many years, you do really begin to stack up the rejections and you have to begin to, you know, get wider and wider. And the agent I had now, she came about after The Summer That Melted Everything was already published. So she, of course, knew my history with agents and sort of where I was at my life in terms of publishing my next book and all that. So I think it worked out the way it should have.
That's really interesting. I'm so glad I asked you that question. Okay, I want to just mention again that the title of your book is The Summer That Melted Everything, which is a great title, by the way, by Tiffany McDaniel and published by St. Martin's Press. Tiffany, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a blast.
You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Tiffany McDaniel. Her new novel, The Summer That Melted Everything, came out this month from St. Martin's Press, and you can read more about her work at tiffanymcdaniel.com. This week's Write the Book prompt has to do with the play of expectation that was central to Tiffany McDaniel's debut novel, The Summer That Melted Everything. As we talked about during the interview, she has a character who self-identifies as the devil, and she has another character who sort of sees himself as a very, you know, upright citizen. And in fact, those two characters aren't what you expect when you first meet them. So in your own world, consider a recent misunderstanding, perhaps someone you underestimated or misread, or someone who maybe underestimated or misread you, and write about that experience. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org. And that's every Monday at 3. A second hour features reruns and sometimes new content. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org.